The following talk was given by Mary Sullivan at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on July 13, 2025. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
I'm going to apologize to Roger in advance. I'm going to speak from this book, Thich Nhat Hanh's book on anger. I've heard you say that you've gotten rid of it a couple of times. Is that true? Am I putting you on the spot? Oh, the Thich Nhat Hanh's book on anger. Yeah, that's what I remember you're saying that. So I am going to speak on the topic of anger. David has been reading this book for a variety of reasons. Anger is one of the three poisons in Buddhism: greed, anger, and self-delusion. As Thich Nhat Hanh refers to them, craving, anger, and confusion. I haven't read a whole lot of it. So for those of you who don't know, but I'm sure most, if not all of you, are familiar with Thich Nhat Hanh, he is a Vietnamese Zen Buddhist monk. He's written many books, including Old Path, White Clouds, which is a biography of the Buddha. Great book. Peace is Every Step. The Miracle of Mindfulness. Another wonderful book. The Heart of the Buddha's Teaching about the Heart Sutra. And The Diamond That Cuts Through Illusion, which is about the Diamond Sutra. And these are just a few of his works. Thich Nhat Hanh was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize by Martin Luther King Jr. He has written at length about the parallels between Buddhism and Christianity, and specifically of those between Buddha and Christ. When I started putting together this talk, in my mind, examples from the New Testament of how Jesus taught people to cool the flames of anger came to mind. The subtitle of this book on anger is Wisdom for Cooling the Flames. Let me just say that I was raised a Catholic. I attended Catholic school from grades 1 through 10. And I think that's why the examples from Christianity came to mind. The first example was that of the stoning of the adulteress. In brief, Jesus came upon a situation. And by the way, if you have more knowledge of these situations than I do, don't hesitate to speak up. Or let me know you want to say something. Jesus came upon a situation where men were preparing to stone an adulteress to death. I would imagine that in order to do this, one would have to summon up some anger, specifically about having been cuckolded, made a fool of, possibly. And what Jesus said to the man was, "Let he who is without sin cast the first stone." What strikes me about this is that he was teaching the men to look at their own hearts and minds. He was, in fact, teaching them mindfulness, the bases of mindfulness. The second situation that came to mind was what Jesus prayed as he was preparing to be crucified. This scene occurred in the Garden of Gethsemane, I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. He said, praying to God the Father, and we can't go into the esoterics of the Trinity. He said, praying to God the Father, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do, because he knew what was coming in the way of the suffering of the crucifixion and death he was about to undergo. And he was expressing compassion. This seemed to me like an act of great compassion. He was asking for forgiveness of the Father on their behalf. It seemed like he was, and I'm interpreting Jesus's actions here, trying to mitigate or head off the potential for God's wrath, God the Father's wrath. Again, there's a lot of underlying esoteric Christianity here, but I think these are good examples. In the third situation that came to mind, Jesus does get angry. He expressed his anger in what I thought was an appropriate way. He saw the money lenders had taken up money lending in the temple. And the temple, of course, was his father's house, and drove them out. The temple was a sacred place, a holy place, a house of worship. And this seemed totally appropriate to me. Now, I'm not sure Thich Nhat Hanh would have agreed with this, because Thich Nhat Hanh doesn't seem to think anger is appropriate. But I don't know. I haven't read the entire book, as I said. Basically, Thich Nhat Hanh sees mindfulness and compassion as the antidotes to anger. And so that's why I thought those stories about Jesus teaching mindfulness and compassion were compelling. Anger comes up in relationships, of course. Being in a long-term relationship, I can attest to that. I've noticed that I can become deaf to what David is saying is angering him in the moment. Becoming defensively deaf is not the way. Let me just say, like many powerful emotions, anger is contagious. Laughter is contagious. Passion is contagious. I'm sure we can think of other examples, but anger is definitely contagious. And I think that's one of the things that is motivating Thich Nhat Hanh to present it in the way he does, because of how contagious anger is. When we hear angry speech, we get angry and want to say angry things back, which only ratchets up anger. This is on page 3. Thich Nhat Hanh says he or she is always ready to complain or blame others for his or her problems. And so you find it very unpleasant to listen to him or her and try to avoid him or her. He says, to understand and transform anger, we must learn the practice of compassionate listening and using loving speech. And then he mentions the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, regarder of the cries of the world. There's a great chapter in Katagiri's book, You Have to Say Something, on Avalokiteshvara, the Buddha, she's also known as Kuan Yin, the Bodhisattva of compassion, regarder of the cries of the world. And he says, we must all learn the practice of deep listening, like this bodhisattva. Then we can offer very concrete guidance to those who come seeking for help in order to restore communication. He says, listening with compassion can help the other person to suffer less. Yet even if you have the best intentions, you have to train yourself in the art of compassionate listening. This requires other virtues like patience. If you sit down quietly, if you can sit down quietly and listen compassionately to that person for 1 hour, you can relieve a lot of suffering. He says you have to be very concentrated while you listen. You have to focus on the practice of listening. And it is a practice done with your whole body, your whole being, your eyes, your ears, your body, your mind. If you just pretend to listen, and people will know, they know when you're pretending to listen, and do not listen with 100% of yourself, the other person will not find relief from his suffering. He says it's a very compassionate listening is basically a very deep practice. You listen not to judge or blame. You listen just because you want the other person to suffer less. Learning to listen to the other person can really help him or her to transform her anger and suffering. What I didn't realize was how central to this practice of listening breathing. He says, if you know how to practice mindful breathing and can stay focused on the desire to help the other person find relief, then you will be able to sustain your compassion while you listen. And I had just, it had never occurred to me. Whoops. Page two, David said, did you number your pages? Oh yeah, I numbered my pages. I just forgot an entire page. No, I didn't. Okay. This may be a shorter talk than I planned. So what about this breathing? But anyway, he says, on page 29, anger is like a howling baby, suffering and crying. The baby needs mother to embrace her. The moment you begin to practice breathing mindfully, you begin to practice, and you have the, he says, I'm sorry, the moment you begin to practice breathing mindfully, in and out, you have the energy of a mother to cradle and embrace the baby. So what is this mindful breathing? We practice it in Zazen all the time. It's noticing that you're breathing in as you breathe in and noticing that you're breathing out as you breathe out. Thich Nhat Hanh says, to breathe in consciously is to know that the air is entering your body. And that's an actually very physical experience, noticing the air is entering your body. We talk about the air going down. We talk about expanding the lower abdomen when we breathe. So this is not shallow breathing. This is not chest breathing. This is abdominal breathing when we sit in meditation and breathe. And he says, and to breathe out consciously is to know that your body is exchanging air. This is how we breathe during Zazen. He says it needs only conscious breathing. Oh, I'm sorry. It needs only one conscious breath to be back in contact with yourself. Isn't that interesting? One conscious breath to be back in contact with yourself. And three conscious breaths to maintain that contact. You're smiling. May I ask why? Good question. I don't have a good answer to that. Thich Nhat Hanh does do that in this book. But I think what he's trying to say is we don't need a lot of experience. It's like we do. We're not working too hard at this. We're not stressing and straining. This is moment by moment awareness. And it doesn't involve working so hard at it that we become discouraged. We give up. We quit. We talk about this. This is why we talk about in Zazen about having no expectations of attaining enlightenment. As Dogen says, have no designs on becoming a Buddha. So I think he's saying in this, when we are just willing to let the breath, we are conscious of the breath coming in as we breathe in, and we're conscious of the breath going out as we breathe out. And we just maintain momentary, moment by moment awareness of this. We don't have to work so hard at it because it's heartfelt, it's sincere, and we're not trying to get anything from it. And I think that's part of what compassion is. Not trying to get anything from listening compassionately, except to listen compassionately. Any questions or comments so far? David.
So three breaths, so he said, if you are consumed with anger and you notice it, then you start to breathe consciously. In 5 minutes,
yeah,
you will have been able to not be consumed with anger.
That's true.
And then he says, but it might take a little more.
15.
10 minutes. 15 minutes.
Yeah, he does. He says that. Yeah. Don't hold yourself to that. Don't have any expectations about that. That's what moment-to-moment awareness is about. Just being fully awake, fully aware in this moment. In the next moment, or rather, in this moment, in this moment, in this moment, with no expectations of sustaining it. I think that's important. Let me see. You know, he says a lot about, and I don't necessarily agree with him. About, well, never mind. I'm not going to go there. He says, when you get angry, go back to yourself and take very good care of your anger. When someone makes you suffer, go back and take care of your suffering, your anger. Do not say or do anything. Whatever you say or do, in a state of anger, may cause more damage in your relationship. He says, most of us don't do that We want to go back. We don't want to go back to ourselves. We don't want to look into our own hearts and minds. We want to follow the other person to punish him or her. I'm not saying that's wrong or bad. I'm saying that's what human beings do. And I think that's the whole purpose of this practice, just to make us aware of what we do as human beings, of what can become routinized, can become an automatic reaction, rather than noticing where the anger is, noticing that the anger causes pain and suffering in us, and therefore we want to avoid transmitting that pain and suffering. Because as I said, did I say it? Anger is contagious. Anger is like laughter. Did I say this already? Yeah. I don't know if any of you saw Mary Poppins. There's a scene. I was obsessed with Mary Poppins. When I was 12, I saw it many times. There's this scene in which there's a guy, I can't remember the actor's name. He's saying, "I love to laugh." And he's laughing and laughing and laughing. And he actually rises up and he starts bouncing off the ceiling. You remember that? It's a great scene. And there's a joyousness to it. And also a compassion to it, because it's offering one's own enjoyment to others, one's own enjoyment of laughter to others. I love that scene. Anyway. He says, here it is. Here's what David was saying. He says, it needs only one conscious breath to be back in contact with yourself and everything around you, and three conscious breaths to maintain the contact. He says, he talks about transforming the garbage of anger, which he sees as compost, that will nourish the flowers in your garden, similar to some of the things that I think Suzuki Roshi says. He says, you can do it too. It is not something only a great being can do. You can transform the garbage of anger into the flower of compassion. Many of us can do this in just 15 minutes, he says. The secret is to continue the practice of mindful breathing, the practice of mindful walking, generating the energy of mindfulness in order to embrace your anger. You know, I found that very interesting because it had not occurred to me before I read this, that the practice of breathing mindfully can help with anger. It never occurred to me. I thought, I'll just watch my own mind. I'll just watch, notice, pay attention, and therefore not act out of whatever ideas, prejudices, beliefs, confusion is being stirred up. I never thought of using mindful breathing to come back to this moment, to help listen, to help, as he says, cool the flames of anger. It surprised me. It surprised me that I had never thought of it. He says, if you see elements of garbage in you, like fear, despair, hatred, don't panic. He says, you can recognize this. I am going to transform this garbage into nourishing compost that can make love reappear. And then he says, as you continue embracing your anger or despair, which you can do by generating the energy of mindfulness, then you can practice looking deeply into the nature of anger. It has, so the practice has two phases. One is embracing and recognizing. And this is his quote, "My dear anger," Thich Nhat Hanh's very interesting, "I know you are there. I am taking good care of you, like you do a crying baby." The second phase is to look deeply into the nature of your anger, to see how it has come about. And then he talks about discovering the true nature of your anger, stopping the cycle of anger. I was raised by angry parents. I did not realize the deep source of pain and suffering that drove their anger till I was an adult. I just didn't understand. I didn't know. And frequently this anger that I experienced was fueled, as you might imagine, by alcohol. Thich Nhat Hanh talks about how alcohol will fuel anger and to avoid it at all costs. He doesn't mince words. But he also says, he talks about noticing the passing on of generational anger. and he observed this in a 12-year-old boy who had a problem with his father, because every time he made a mistake or fell and hurt himself, instead of helping, his father would shout at him and call him all sorts of names. "You stupid boy. How can you do something like that to yourself?" This would happen just because the boy would fall down and get hurt. So he didn't see his father as a loving father, as a good father. If his son was playing, he promised himself that when he grew up, got married, and had children, he would not treat his children like that. If his son was playing and got hurt and bled, he would not shout at him. He would embrace his son and try to help him. When I was contemplating having children, I didn't think that was possible. I didn't know you could be reborn again, as he says, in this practice. I didn't know that just by bringing breathing, mindful breathing, and moment by moment awareness to what's happening, that one could actually escape the seeming chains of having been reacted to with anger as a child, seeing one's brothers being reacted to with anger as a child. And one day this boy, he was in Plum Village. It was his second year, and he had come with his younger sister. And she was playing with other girls on the hammock, and suddenly she fell off. She hit her head on a piece of rock, and blood began to stream down her face. And his first impulse was to go and shout at her, "You stupid girl. How could you do something like that to yourself?" And he was about to do the same thing that his father did to him. But because he had practiced in Plum Village for 2 summers, he was able to stop himself. Instead of shouting, he began to practice mindful breathing and mindful walking, while others helped his sister. In just 5 minutes, Stikhan says, he experienced a moment of enlightenment. He saw that his reaction, his anger, was a kind of habit energy. He had become exactly like his father, the continuation of his father, and he did not want to treat his sister like that. But the energy transmitted to him by his father was so strong that he almost did exactly what his father had done to him. For a 12-year-old boy, that is quite an awakening. He continued his walking, and suddenly he was filled with the desire to practice in order to transform this habit energy so he would not transmit it to his children. He knew that only the practice of mindfulness could help him to stop this cycle of suffering. And we're coming to 10:33. So I'm going to tell you just a brief story and then end here. We go to about 10:30. Okay, this story. So one of the ways that I came to try to manage this generational anger that I'd observed was I went into therapy. But the most helpful therapy, I was in my 20s, late 20s, I think, early to mid 20s, late 20s, I don't know, was group therapy. And I observed this very thing in I observed a man tell this story, one of the members of the group, whom I really liked. He was a lawyer. And he said, one day, he became very angry with his young son. And he started to take off his belt in order to beat him with the belt out of sheer anger with his son. And in his son's face, he saw utter terror, utter terror. And suddenly he saw himself as a child in that same situation where his father was starting to take off his belt to beat him. And he experienced that terror that he had as a young boy. And he saw that in the face of his son. And it stopped him in his tracks. And he never did that again. I was really moved by that story. And I thought this is exactly what Thich Nhat Hanh is pointing to in this chapter. This mindfulness, this awareness. And this man had to be open to his son's suffering at some level in order to see this, open and respond with compassion, with an open heart to his son's suffering in order to relieve not only his son's suffering, but his own. Because in doing that to his son, if he had continued to do so, he was suffering terribly as well. And we often don't see that. Okay, it's 10:35. I'm done. Any questions or comments?
One thing that Thich Nhat Hanh says later on in the book is really prescriptive.
Yes.
If you have an argument with your beloved, then there are three sentences that you need to say within the first 24 hours.
Yeah.
You need to say, darling, I am suffering. And then you need to say, darling, I am doing my best, which means that you are practicing mindful breathing, mindful walking, mindful sitting. You're doing your best to try to take care of yourself. But then you need to say, darling, I need your help. And if the kerfluffle is strong enough, then you need to give it some time and say, let's get together on Friday. If this is Tuesday, let's get together on Friday. And by then, I will be able to listen compassionately to you, and perhaps you'll be able to listen compassionately to me. But if things get better before then, you can go ahead and you know, then by Friday comes around, you've already got this all settled and you can have a nice weekend. But he's real prescriptive about step one, step two, step three, like that, in order to take care of yourself, take care of the situation, take care of your beloved, all this.
Yes. Yes, Roger.
Yeah, I admit, I think there's a lot of good stuff in the book, and I think it's a great topic. I mean, you could practically have this topic once a month. Anger's, but I don't like the book, and I don't even like Thich Nhat Hanh, so...
I have to ask.
And yeah, I think the book is unrealistic in some ways. It's very useful. But I think there's a role of anger. Anger has a place in our lives. It's very important. We need to be angry at times. I can't remember the example, exactly what examples you gave of Jesus, but, one of my favorite is he, very angrily chases the money lenders out.
That was the example I gave.
Yeah. And there's a place for anger. Just a couple of nights ago, there was a car where I live. I'm on the first floor. There was a car that sat for 45 minutes with its motor running. It sounded like a motorcycle. So I went out in a very angry mood and I knocked on the window. They didn't answer. They had tinted windows. So I went back in the house to get a pad. I was angry at this point. And we have a rule about cars in our parking lot. And I was got a pad. I came out. And I was going to write down the plate and call the police immediately. Because he shouldn't have been there. And... I think we often have to be angry about something and stay angry. And I think there's a short-term anger that we need. And I think there's a long-term anger that we need that doesn't have to do with the people around us. I like all the examples you gave. That's all very true. But just going to Texas, for example, as a state, Texas is a state that for a long time has refused to spend the money to take care of problems in the state in the way that Minnesota does spend money. And so I feel a kind of long-term dislike of Texas.
Along with Thich Nhat Hanh.
Yeah, I don't like the way they take their government in Texas. And I think the loss of many children in the last week shows that Texas is a state that we should feel angry about. So that's basically, I could probably go on for about another hour or so about the uses of anger, but I think it does play a role in our part, in our life.
I want to ask you a question. Of what use, you said it has a use, long-term anger. Of what use is your anger toward Texas? Of what use?
The use is that it makes us work for a better world. And it makes us work for solutions. I'll just bring up another topic, too, not to get into it. But
well, Catherine actually had a question. So I wanted to give her a chance to ask.
Yeah, okay.
You mentioned, was it Avalokiteshvara and hearing the cries of the world?
What?
Avalokiteshvara and hearing the cries of the world?
Yes.
What's after that? We hear the cries of the world and then what?
Regarder of the cries of the world.
Regarder?
Regarder of the cries of the world.
What does
what
it
do you mean,
regard
what's
after the cries of the world?
That's a whole topic. What do you mean, what's after that?
Yeah, what is it? what does it mean to regard the cries of the world, just to acknowledge that you hear them?
I think it means compassion.
It means to acknowledge the suffering that we suffer. And Avalokiteshvara sees that.
Yeah.
And she is the Bodhisattva of compassion, Kuan Yin. And as Thich Nhat Hanh says, one antidote to anger is compassion. And this regarder of the cries of the world this is compassionate listening. This is listening with no judgment, no blame, no accusations, no intent behind it to change anything, just to listen. That's the best I can.
Yeah, I just was thinking of some things that happen in the world, and you know, there's an outcry, hue and cry about what has gone on and why officials are not doing X, Y, or Z about it, and people getting weary and tired of the prayers of everyone is with those who suffer. You know, that they're saying the prayers are not enough, that there's some action that's needed. I don't know. It's a big topic, but, you know.
Well, I do think you can mistake compassion for passivity.
Yeah.
And that may be why one of the reasons Thich Nhat Hanh gives this very scripted dialogue that David was talking about when you talk to your loved one about your suffering, your anger, and just wanting to listen. And I think he's aware of that, and he offers scripted dialogue, what to do on a larger scale. That's going to continue to, we're always going to have problems.
Yeah.
Those, we live in muddy water. We live in muddy water. And I think to acknowledge that we do live in muddy water, but it also says we live in muddy water with purity like a lotus. Nothing surpasses the boundless mind. So this is the mind of compassion. This is not the mind that sets, as the Xin Qing Ming says, that sets what it likes against what it dislikes. This is an open mind.
Mm-hmm. The existing with purity like a lotus in muddy water, the muddy water and the purity of the lotus are linked. They're intertwined. That's been remarked to me.
That's right, because the muddy water nourishes.
Correct.
We are nourished by the muddy water.
Yes.
That's right. You're right.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Can you hear us, the people that are watching by video?
Yes.
Did you hear that? I think Mary had a comment or a question she wanted to give. Am I correct about that? And I didn't want to speak before you. I wanted to give you a chance to say what you wanted.
Oh, that's nice. I know we're running out of time, so I put my hand down.
That's okay. Go ahead.
I wondered about what happens when you have anger, but it's not safe to be angry. Perhaps that was your experience when you were a child with your angry parents.
That's a good point.
Was it safe to be angry?
No. That's an excellent point. It was not safe to be angry. That's really a good point. And, you know, the psychoanalysts say depression is anger turned inward. And that's one of the ways in which anger can not poison you so much as make you ill. It can cause you to be depressed. And I know that for a while there was working on this, I wouldn't say anything. For the longest time, I had to keep my mouth shut. And so I started to learn just to speak up in group therapy. It was very helpful that way. But no, you're right. It was not safe to talk. It was not safe to express. needs, desires, if there was not convenient or there was more neediness going on in perhaps the parent than in the child in some ways. But as I said, I also didn't know the source of that pain and suffering in my own parents until later.
Thank you.
And that was helpful. Does that address what you said?
I have a comment. Is there enough time?
Why not?
And I'm Lily. I don't know why I show up as a number, but I'm Lily.
Who is this?
Can you see me? In the audience.
No.
Who is this?
Lily.
Lily.
Okay.
I was fortunate to witness a situation where I'm kind of a fist up, you know, mouth open type person and trying to learn that there's better ways. And I got to witness that. Suzuki Roshi, a lot of the time his answer to things was shut up, which used to make me mad to hear him say that. And we have, unfortunately or fortunately, a bully in our family who says things that are very cutting and very painful. And I have encountered him a few times and had something to say and wasn't effective. On this occasion, he made some very just devastating remarks directed at another just innocent person. And this person's significant other was standing by to hear this. And I thought, uh-oh, something's going to happen here. But I watched this significant other. Just this composure came over him. And he just stood and silent in a way that you recognize it. You hear it. You see it. And he said not a word. And our bully finished his remarks. And you could kind of see that he had become actually uncomfortable because there was this silence. And he was left in it to his own embarrassment. Nothing more was said. So I said later to the significant other, that was really good. You showed him, you showed the bully to the person he attacked who he was. Let him show himself. And he said, I wasn't going to land his blow for him. And let it where it started, where the anger started, let it remain. And he went on with his day, had a really good day and, you know, didn't carry it with him. And the bully was kind of left. It's the first time I'd ever seen him and I spent a lifetime around him. First time I'd ever seen him look sorry for what he'd done or at least feel some shame. And it was all about that moment of shutting up. And it wasn't done in such a way you could feel it. You could see that quietness. You could see that silence. And so it wasn't not reacting. It wasn't letting somebody get away with it. But it was this, I'm not going to land the blow for you. And it helped the person that was being attacked by it see, look what you're dealing with. Look who you're dealing with. That's enough. That's enough. So to me, that has been very impactful. It's such a different way of looking at things. To keep your peace, to remain peaceful, to have a response. It was something very different and very impactful to me.
Thank you. I can understand why that would be impactful. I do want to say something on the bully's behalf. I think by referring to him as a bully, we've demonized him. And I think the bully, by the significant other's silence, enabled the bully to hear himself. Now, I'm speculating here, But it sounds to me like there was also some listening going on the part of the bully. Because never forget, he too is a bodhisattva. Mm-hmm. He too is a Buddha. He too is, as Norm says, awake and aware. That's our true nature. Our true nature is one of enlightenment, of awakeness and awareness, regardless of how we behave. And I think that he might just have had the opportunity afforded by the significant other to hear himself. So I really appreciate your story.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. So it's now 10:53. Shall we end it? Okay.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.